Missing the Kiss, and The Point. Teacher Union Fantasy, Charity for Them, and Stuff for You, all on Last Impressions number 8. I'm Justin Katz. Welcome back. If you're not Generation X like me, you might not have picked up that was Guns N' Roses' Paradise City taking us in there, or my piano rendition. There'll be more at the end of the podcast, or a little bit more. Probably you'll be thankful that it's only a little bit. So I'm going to start off today with another reference back to the good old days of the Gen X childhood with Bill Murray's Groundhog Day. And this is Jonah Goldberg of National Review and American Enterprise Institute and other places talking on his Glop podcast on Ricochet.com about his favorite moment in that movie.
There's one of my favorite scenes, most underrated scene in Groundhog Day, is the scene where, so on one of the endless nights, Bill Murray has this absolutely perfect, spontaneous moment with Andy McDowell where he's building a snowman building a snowman and then some kids throw snowballs and he defends her honor and pretends to be a knight. And it's just this great romantic moment. And he then spends presumably half an eternity trying to recreate this organic romantic moment and never can.
Right.
And that's such a big part of life, is that you cannot sort of recreate or create authentic moments that way, because the second anybody is in on it, audience or participant, it's just not the same.
All right, now being kind of geeky, that the first thing that comes to my mind is that's a lot like the quantum observer, in quantum mechanics and physics, it's understood that you can't measure something or observe something without affecting it in some way. At least from your perspective, it gets weird, but it's a lot like that. You can't live the moment while looking at it and observing it and thinking it. We find this on the Budget Committee in Tiverton, for example, where you're trying to take notes for your minutes and you can't really pay attention. It's a different kind of a thing. Or when I used to live blog, same kind of principle. But apart from all of that, it seems to me that Jonah Goldberg was kind of missing one of the key points of that moment in a movie. If I'm remembering correctly, and I have seen it since I was a teenager, but if I'm remembering correctly, the whole reason Bill Murray, as a shallow character at that point, wanted to recreate the moment was that he didn't get the kiss he was about to get. That's when he's about to kiss Andy McDowell's character, and that's when the snowball comes, and that's when they get up and have the snowball fight, and he wants to skip the snowball fight and get back to the kiss, because that's what he was after, the material pleasure, and he never gets there. But one of the key things he misses, of course, is that in that moment the kiss didn't matter. It was about the moment. And I wonder whether we're kind of doing this same thing on a cultural level. We're trying to control everything, especially for our kids. We're trying to make everything safe. We're trying to get government involved in everything to make sure there are no sharp edges on life. And we're missing the point. Organized sports or whatever. We're missing. It's commonplace to say we're missing the creativity of the taking the risks and thrill of life and the lessons. But I wonder if there's something much more fundamental, almost to the point of quantum physics, that we're just missing the point. We're trying to get to the kiss, the material pleasure, the safety, the security. But we're missing meaning. We're missing the enjoyment of life as it is, and kind of shifting. Not really shifting gears. I'll work my way back to it. But if you want to talk about missing the point, here is National Education Association of Rhode Island. That's one of the two big teachers' unions here. The executive director, Bob Walsh, was on Rhode Island Public Radio's political roundtable, and I've already brought this up because it stunned me that he pretty much admitted that his union is on the Democrat Party team, and nobody batted an eye. So John DePietro and I talked about this. I put up a post on the Ocean State Current, but there was another key point that shouldn't be missed in this moment.
Why hasn't Rodin made more progress in improving public education?
Lack of resources is the first thing that comes to mind.
Let me just push back on that for a second. The Journal did a comparison of public education in Rodin and Massachusetts a couple of months ago, and the per pupil spending was pretty close to equal. I mean, not exactly equal, but it wasn't that far off.
It was probably 5 or 10% off, but then you have to look at what goes into the per pupil spending, and we have a much higher pension legacy cost right off the bat.
A lack of resources? That was Ian Donis of Rhode Island Public Radio kind of pushing back on Bob Walsh there. But a lack of resources? Is he crazy? I mean, first of all, his numbers were wrong. The Massachusetts and Rhode Island's expenditures per pupil are very close. And the idea that we're going to take pensions out of this equation, that's part legacy costs. What is legacy costs? That's part of the expense. Lack of resources. You don't lack resources. When you give away your resources on something like lavish pension deals that allow teachers to retire at 50 and get a second career and then maybe collect two or three pensions in their lifetime, that's when you give that away, those are your resources. You're not lacking them. You gave them up. You gave them to something you didn't need, something that didn't apply to educating children. You gave it away to his members, which is what he wants. And we're fools, I guess, if we fall for it. But what Walsh goes on to do is to blame parents. He essentially says, look, Massachusetts is much wealthier. If you put Rhode Island cities and towns compared with Massachusetts cities and towns, On income, Barrington is almost like in the middle. Some of our most wealthy municipalities don't even rate versus Massachusetts. And that's true. But then resources aren't the issue, right? The issue is the economy. So we're throwing money into his union members' pockets for no benefit at all. We're just wasting it, essentially, even when it's not going to pensions. But back to that. Labor unions are strangling Rhode Island. There's no other way to put it. It's just, as far as I'm concerned, an objective fact. And here he is with the audacity to demand more. Just keep on saying more and making excuses and citing statistics, well, incorrectly, but also deceptively in order to confuse people into thinking, oh, yeah, we just need more resources. And now the relevance of this to the moment in Groundhog Day and the idea of not being able to recreate a special moment is that in this public policy debate, we're not even talking about things that are real anymore. We're talking about fantasy statistics not related to education, and we're just talking around the key points. We're arguing essentially about different pretend versions of reality. And the thing of it is, on some level, we all know it to be phony, which is why I think the guys and gal on the political roundtable didn't notice or didn't remark on the fact that Walsh was admitting his group is essentially a Democrat Party front, because we've all known that to be true. So when he actually admits it, you know, up till now we were pretending. Now we don't have to, but you almost don't notice when you go from that shift of pretending versus not having to pretend. We all know it was phony. And in some regards, I guess we're to a more honest debate. Maybe now we'll break through to a sort of a meta level where we can have an actual debate about the false debate that we've been having. Another of my usual sources for this podcast is the Commentary Magazine podcast, also on Ricochet. It's John Podhoretz and Noah's last name, and Abe Greenwald. Just talk about usually national politics and some cultural stuff, but mainly politics. And they got to a similar point about arguing about things that are a non-reality, talking about President Donald Trump's executive order, or second iteration of his executive order, limiting immigration, refugees or immigration from certain high-risk countries, all of which happen to be majority Muslim. So they're talking about that and the way the courts essentially just responded immediately, invalidating it. And they make a very key point. So this is John Podhoretz, followed by Abe Greenwald, making the point that I really want to get to.
And if we're now getting into reading the minds and, you know, trying reading the minds of those who drafted it, as opposed to interpreting the document as it is, then anything and everything that Trump will do or will do will be – you'll be able to say doesn't count because he said things you don't like.
But, you know, the whole thing has become such a preposterous sideshow because, as you say, it's a Muslim ban that's not a Muslim ban. The objection to it is an objection that has nothing to do with the actual document. It's a national security – it's a policy that's not actually going to do anything. It's not – it's a supposed security policy that will not have any effect on that. It's purely in the realm of make-believe on both sides, and Trump just desperately wants it as a win.
So no, sorry, I should have introduced that a little bit better. What they're talking about here is how the court systems, the two actually, I think, both district court, U.S. district courts, looked to President Trump's other statements outside of his executive order, just even during the campaign, in order to sort of infer what the document means. And Podhoretz's argument is that they should be just looking at what the executive order does. And you can look to intent if you're trying to understand how a word is being used. But if the practical effect is of the executive order counts as a Muslim ban and they want to find that unconstitutional, then that's one thing. But to infer that he's trying to get to a Muslim ban with this executive order that may not be of itself a Muslim ban, then that's not appropriate. And it struck me that these two guys is kind of odd. They make a great point about not talking. We're no longer arguing about reality, but it's odd that they missed what I think is a key point here. This is essentially President Obama in reverse. Everybody knew when he pushed things through, whether it was Obamacare or whatever, or whenever he got anything through, which wasn't as much as he wanted, I'm sure. But he expanded it then through executive orders and other administrative actions. And that was fine. The courts actually blessed that, particularly with Obamacare. They said, you know what, you can – some of it they didn't, like the not allowing states to skip the Medicaid expansion. The courts allowed that. But in large other sections of his activity, and more as a theme, he took what pretenses of authority the law action Congress actually gave him and turned them into what he wanted them to be. And for the most part, the courts were okay with that. I mean, at least the leftist activist lawyers and judges were, and right-wing lawyers and activist lawyers and judges don't really do that. Our activism is, yeah, I'm going to be an activist and apply the law as it's written. But so the difference is they approved of it with Obama. With Trump, they don't. So essentially they're saying, and this is often people, conservatives say of progressives and those on the left, if you want to know what they're doing, look at what they're accusing us of doing. It's the same principle here. They know what Obama did. They know what they normally do with anything. Say same-sex marriage or whatever, they get something under the camel's nose into the tent through saying it's not going to be this will never happen, you know, equal rights amendment. Oh, somebody, I believe this is factual, but somebody said, literally predicted that it would mean same-sex marriage. And everyone said, oh, that's crazy. But this is what the left does, is they, no, we're just doing this little thing, and then they push it and expand it, just like people had presumed that Obamacare's intention was to lead to single payer, because single payer would never have passed. So you get the camel's nose in the tent, and eventually you can push the whole beast in there. And so essentially the left knows this is what they do, and so they assume it's what Donald Trump does. And but when the right does it, the left uses its power to say, oh, no, you're not allowed to do that. We know what you're really trying to do, and we're going to stop it because they have power at the moment and the media goes along with them. Another moment in that commentary podcast, though, was they went on to say that President Trump essentially was sort of threatening the courts to say, hey, if you drop this one, I'm going back to the other one and we're going to push it. We're going to force it. And all three of the commentators on commentary podcast were saying, oh, you this isn't business. You can't negotiate with the courts. And that to me misses the point. Yes, you can. With activist courts, you can absolutely negotiate them with them. And in fact, that is what people think is going on, what they know is going on, and it's what they don't like. This is one of the key points behind the antipathy toward the establishment, is that things aren't running as they're supposed to. So it's just kind of weird that these particular commentators would miss that. But getting back to the idea of looking at real reality versus fake reality, Andrew Klavan on his own podcast took up another area where we really could use more clarity of thought, because we go wrong in our handling it without it. And he's talking about charity here. And it actually has to do a lot with a fight I'm having locally in Tiverton, and a fight that I think we on the right have to take up at every level of government. Here's Andrew Klavan.
The whole thing about charity is charity ennobles the giver and it creates responsibility in the person who receives it, right? It ennobles you because you're letting go of something for a good purpose, and it means the receiver then is kind of responsible to you. You know, if he's a drunk, or if he's doing something wrong, if he's doing something that is making his life go bad, then he now becomes responsible to a church or to a person, and it gives him at least a shot of elevating himself. If you get welfare, you have what's called welfare psychosis. This is a word I learned from a person who worked in the welfare department. It's called welfare psychosis, where you begin to think that you deserve what is essentially other people's money. Other people worked to earn the welfare you are receiving. And yet, when you receive it from the government, you begin to think it's an entitlement.
I like that, welfare psychosis. Now, locally, I'm encountering this because I think it's actually a really small group, but are expressing outrage that I would suggest that the town government shouldn't be taking taxpayer money and giving it to charities. We absolutely have an obligation as individuals and as people in the community to be charitable, but for the government to take money from all of us in order for the few people with power to distribute it, that's not appropriate. That needs to end. That creates this welfare psychosis, whether it's Head Start or food kitchens. I mean, we all ought to be participating in these things, not Head Start. Studies show it's useless waste of money. But real, genuine charity, we're obligated to do that, I think. But not, as Andrew Klavan says earlier, right, a few moments before that statement that I just played, he says, you know, it doesn't say anywhere in the Bible or the New Testament that you have to take other people's money to give it to charity. And that's what government being charitable is. And it's not just the sense of entitlement. It is not just the entitlement sense of welfare. It permeates our government. And it's a real huge problem we have to address. Another thing in a Tiverton budget, and I'm sure this is the same elsewhere, we spend, I think it's $2,500 a year on what we call, the line item is winter recreation. But what it is, as far as I can tell, is a Christmas party and a trunk or treat event where, you know, people drive up and they decorate their trunks of their cars and they give out candy. Now, both of these things, having worked with some nonprofits, these are things that nonprofits do to make money normally. This is normally a fundraiser for private organizations. And here the government is taking our money to pay for it to be done. That's just wrong. First of all, you get this sense of entitlement now where the people who enjoy these events and want them to go on and want to participate feel entitled to take other people's money to have it happen rather than to give their own money as a charitable event in ennobling them. But instead, they're now the recipients. But also, if the government's doing it and subsidizing it and it's therefore free, you're taking away the opportunity for private charities or private nonprofits to do these things as fundraisers. When I was on a PTO for one of the local Catholic schools, there were all these fairs. Every school and other places had spring fairs, fall fairs, this fair, that fair. And as a parent before I was on a PTO, I was getting overwhelmed with the choices of fairs that you could go to with rides and candy and stuff for the kids. So if the government is doing that, how many trunk or treats do people really want to go to? If you take the government one away, that opens the possibility for these parents maybe to raise money and be charitable, or for a nonprofit to say, hey, here's a gap, here's a way we can give kids something to do. And of course, this ties back to the original thing, because one of the reasons people do these trunk or treats is that it's safe to go around among cars in a public place rather than door to door, taking away, erasing a huge part of everybody's childhood if that becomes becomes more normal. You know, hear about people, parents taking their kids to the mall where the stores are giving out candy. How much more could you miss the meaning and the point of a community activity where you go door to door and meet your neighbors and show them your costume and how, I don't know what we're doing. But anyway, the idea of charity also brings me back, as seems to always happen in these podcasts, maybe counterintuitively, to Econ Talk with Russ Roberts. And he has two podcasts ago, he was interviewing Robert Waples, who's an economics professor at Wake Forest University. And he edited a book of economists reviewing Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment and the economy. So here you've got two free market economists, one Jewish, one Catholic, talking about Pope Francis's view of economics and charity.
Some listeners are going to be offended by this. So I want to shout, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. They don't like the God talk for one, and they also think, hey, if I want to buy a fancy car or a second, third, fourth, fifth, 18th pair of shoes, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And of course, part of me says that's true. There is nothing wrong with that. But I do find it interesting how much time, because I want to get to this issue, which he condemns of excessive consumption or mm-hmm. materialism that's sort of built into capitalism. Mm-hmm. This idea that I'd encourage readers to think about how much time you spend surfing Amazon or the web more generally looking for cool stuff to buy, because I know I do.
So that was Russ Roberts, the host, speaking there. And the he in there is Pope Francis, a Roman Catholic pope. what's interesting there is that insinuation that his listeners would be offended at the suggestion that they shouldn't go out and get more stuff, and it makes me think we're missing the whole point. I guess that's the theme. Everybody's missing a point except me, naturally. But the issue isn't the stuff and the consumerism and going out and buying stuff. It isn't excess or lack. It's being aware of why you want or need the stuff, and weighing that awareness against an honest assessment of other goods. So if the release, the sort of emotional release of shopping and wasting a bit of time and a bit of money on things, if that keeps you going to do great things, maybe it's fine. If some level of comfort allows you, because of just the way you're made up, to be more charitable or be more motivated to help people and not fall into a depression or a funk or whatever, then you know maybe that's okay. Who, as the phrase from the left often goes, Pope Francis has helped to make it famous, who am I to judge? From the outside, who am I to say that you can't have that 18th pair of shoes? Maybe the motivation in the release of that pair of shoes keeps you going, and that's okay. But you have to weigh that with an honest assessment of your own ability to keep going without that pair of shoes against what it could buy for somebody else. So if you sit down and you think, why do I need this brand new expensive car? And you find that it's just because you think it would make you feel a little better for a moment a day when you're dropping off the kids or pulling up to work, and or you get a look every now and then on a highway that you like. And you weigh that against, I don't know, starving children elsewhere. that might start to advise against the luxury. But again, who are others to judge? So, but the other side of that coin, though, is if others, especially people who care about you, are suspicious, you know, that you're sort of being wasteful for no good purpose, then maybe they're doing a good thing if they ask you to review your own motivation. But this honest weighing of goods is ultimately an honest assessment of reality and meaning and figuring out what life is about. What is it in that moment that's actually special? Is it the kiss, the sensual pleasure, or is it the romance? Is it the connection with another person that you can't fake? Is that the important thing? Maybe that. And obviously, if you've seen the movie, there's no spoiler, even if you haven't seen it, for me to say that that's kind of the point of Groundhog Day, is he has to get the day right. He has to find the thing in the day and that's of value and value that. And if society and public policy and government, if we get in the business of weighing meaning and weighing material goods and prescribing it, is like legislation in Rhode Island that explicitly says we need legislation to punish or reward businesses. When government gets in that mode and takes that authority on itself, then our focus isn't on what's important inherently. It's on the incidental thing. And that starts to become destructive, not only of society and advancement and human flourishing in an economic sense, but also in spiritual well-being. As Andrew Clavin said, you're taking away that ability, that connection of the person to be ennobled by giving to charity, and the other person's being able to take that charity as a human connection that might draw them back to another way of living that doesn't require the charity. So I would encourage everybody to not try to recreate that moment for the kiss. Realize that it was actually the laughter and the snow fight with the kids. That was the point. And if you never get to the point where you get the woman back to the hotel like Bill Murray wanted in Groundhog Day, well, maybe that's just fine. And if you never wrap up your podcast, then maybe that's fine too, but people will stop listening. So that's it for this week. As always, the links to the clips and possibly some other interesting material will be on the post that goes with this podcast. And as always, I'm always looking for feedback. Let me know what you're thinking, and I'll try to adjust. I'm winging this anyway, so I'll try to adjust my method to your madness. Anyway, have a good one.
Just an urchin living under the street. I'm a hard case that's tough to beat. I'm your charity case, so buy me something to eat. I'll pay you at another time. Take it to the end of the line. Take me down to the paradise city where the grass is green and the girls are